Case number 10-1056, Natural Resources Defense Council petitioner versus Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Court for petitioner, Ms. Tauber for respondent, Ms. Bear for intervener.
Yes.
Morning. May it please the court, my name is Paul Court. I'm here today on behalf of the Natural Resources Defense Council. If possible, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case is about the penalty provision in Section 185 of the Clean Air Act. Congress adopted Section 185 in the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments as a last resort for addressing ozone pollution in the worst polluted areas of the country should they fail to meet the one-hour ozone standard after 15 to 20 years of trying. Now here we are, 20 years later, and EPA is announcing in guidance that these most polluted areas can avoid the Section 185 penalty requirements. EPA acknowledges that nothing in the Act gives the agency such authority to discard Section 185, but EPA claims that its decision to fill in the gap in the statute is reasonable because it is consistent with the principles of the anti-backsliding provision of Clean Air Act Section 172E. This case is about who gets to decide the controls that apply in these extremely polluted one-hour ozone areas. Here Congress has designed its detailed strategy, and EPA is not free to rewrite or throw out those decisions. NRDC asked the court to vacate EPA's guidance. My plan was to run through the merits, and I think that will take us into any jurisdictional questions you might have.
Now, suppose we were to agree with you on the notice and comment, the absence of notice and comment.
Right.
Why would we go any further at that point? Well, I know in your brief you suggest, a ruling in your favor could obviate the need for it, but you ask us to go forward.
Right.
The basis for doing that?
Well, the basis is we think it's within the court's discretion to do so. Well, the problem here is this is the third time that EPA has tried to get rid of these subpart 2 requirements, and remanding for EPA to take another crack at this through notice and comment is only going to, allow them to continue to avoid these requirements.
But see, it looks like what you're asking for is an advisory opinion. What you're asking us to do is to tell EPA now what it can or cannot do.
That's fairly typical in a remand situation,
when
the court reaches the statutory question and says, we don't think this is a reasonable interpretation of the statute, go back and try again.
Right. So, but if we think that, if the reason for vacating is the absence of notice and comment rulemaking, then you're facing the problem of an advisory opinion.
Well, I don't think that has to be the only reason for vacating, I guess is what I'm saying. I mean,
can you cite any cases where we've discussed this question?
Well, it more or less came up in Appalachian Power, where the court sent back guidance for failing to go through notice and comment.
Well, that's what we would, if you're right about notice and comment, we'd clearly do that.
Right.
We would send it back.
Right. But in Appalachian Power, the court went through an extended discussion of how EPA's interpretation was not consistent with the regulations that were in place at the time. And then the other example I would point...
What would happen then on remand? What would the agency do? Suppose we agreed with you on the merits here, that the attainment and the program alternatives were unlawful. What would be the purpose of notice and comment rulemaking at that point?
Well, our hope would be that EPA would drop this finally, that we wouldn't see a follow-up rule, that EPA would leave in place the law as it exists now, which says that these areas have to adopt 185 fee programs.
Let me ask you this. Suppose we thought that, I understand your point. If we thought, let's just take two hypotheticals. Suppose we thought that what the agency had done was a clear violation of the statute.
Right.
Okay, then I see your point. But suppose we think that the agency's interpretation is a, suppose we think it's a Chevron 2 question. That is, that the statute's ambiguous and the agency, and that we would defer to the agency's interpretation. Wouldn't we be, in that circumstance, wouldn't we be
prejudging?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, I can see that the concern there, but we obviously don't think that there is room for that conclusion. And
with respect to the program alternative, isn't that a pretty clear Chevron 2 question? In fact, you argue it that way in your brief.
We do, because but certainly there was
the attainment one. You think just flat out violates the statute?
The attainment one is
program. The program one you acknowledge is a, and Supreme Court said this was an ambiguity in the statute.
To a certain degree, and then, you know, promptly limited EPA's ability to fill that gap.
Right. But it's still an ambiguous provision in the statute.
Well, it's just there is no provision. It is, we're talking about statutory silence. And you know, we could have, but we didn't, you know, argued that here where there is no clear delegation of authority, the EPA is not entitled to Chevron deference. Moreover, sort of the exercise that they've gone through, adopting guidance in this sort of informal way, doesn't accrue the same level of discretion. But again, our feeling was that the statutory question is so clear that it doesn't really matter what standard of review you apply.
So a standing question. The agency says that you don't have standing because under their guidance, any alternative has to be no less stringent, so there's no injury.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Right. Well, rather than telling what I think about this, let me go through why injury is plainly occurring right now, and we don't have to wait to see what these alternatives look like. First, let's take the situation in Houston. Houston's violating the one-hour ozone standard. They were on track to adopt a 185 fee program. The guidance came out. They dropped their plans to adopt that 185 fee program because they're meeting the 8-hour ozone standard. And so in Houston, there is no subsequent preparation of an alternative program. They will submit to EPA that they're meeting the 8-hour standard and their obligation is done. So there is nothing equivalent. The 1-hour ozone violations will continue and they will be unpenalized. We submit a standing declaration from Ms. Marilyn McGill, who's a member that lives in Houston, suffering from these 1-hour violations. That injury is occurring now and will continue regardless of what happens down the road. But moreover, and I think this is sort of fundamental, and this goes to what this court said about the 185 fee program in South Coast, or even in those areas like South Coast, like the San Joaquin Valley, that where the penalty has yet to take effect, what EPA has done here is removed the incentive that 185 fee program has created. And this court recognized in South Coast that the 185 fee program was an applicable control and was driving decisions even before the penalty took effect. Because in order to avoid that penalty, sources will look to reduce their emissions. And EPA has lifted that. And so even in these areas that aren't currently subject to the penalty, we're seeing that the purpose and the function of that 185 fee program to drive down those emissions has been removed, and that's injuring folks, NRDC members that are living in those areas. Well, let me turn back to the first question on the merits, which is whether this should have gone through APA notice and comment rulemaking. EPA's own defense of the guidance here shows that what EPA was engaging in when it adopted this guidance was legislative rulemaking. EPA admits that the guidance fills a gap in the statute. On page 34 of their brief, EPA says nothing in the Clean Air Act addresses what controls apply when EPA tightens the standard. Accordingly, there's a gap in the statute that EPA must fill. Before this guidance, no law allowed states to adopt alternative programs in lieu of the Section 185 fee program, whereas here the ozone standard has been tightened. No law allowed EPA to approve alternatives to the Section 185 fee program.
Is that why you're saying this is actually final agency action?
It goes to that.
You changed the legal terrain that before this.
Exactly.
It's available now. There is an option that's available.
Exactly. And they admit this. There was no law. There was nothing that granted states the right to avoid Section 185 under these circumstances. There was a gap in the statute, and they, because they thought it was a congressional oversight or a mistake, entered into this gap-filling exercise. And they admit, too, that their ability to fill this gap comes from their own legislative authority implicitly delegated by Congress. And they cite to Mead on page 34, and they say Congress would expect EPA to be able to speak with the force of law when it fills this space in the enacted law. This is the definition of legislative rulemaking. There is no law. EPA steps in, claims this delegated authority to fill that law, and creates this new ability of states to avoid Section 185. So obviously we dispute whether EPA can create this new law, but at a minimum, to engage in this kind of activity requires that they go through notice and comment rulemaking. But we really...
Once the court approved EPA's use by analogy, 172E, did that give the agency the leeway it's claiming?
No, not automatically. I mean, so there are two pieces to this question, right? And I don't, one, we're trying to say, okay, what would Congress intend to occur when EPA tightens an ozone standard? And in the South Coast decision, EPA argued, in response to an argument from Baton Rouge, where Baton Rouge said, you've gotten rid of the one-hour standard, all bets are off, no controls apply. EPA said, no, that doesn't make sense. Under 172E, Congress said, if controls apply, when we controls have to continue to apply, when we relax the standard, it makes sense that those controls would continue to apply when we tighten the standard. And the court agreed and said, that's right. By the way, Section 185 is in control, and that needs to stay in place. So now, following South Coast, EPA is stuck. EPA is back with Section 185 on their plate, the court telling them this is what they have to implement. Everyone then started adopting their 185 fee programs. And then there was this push back to EPA, look, you've got to help us find a way out of this. And EPA said, well, let's see. Section 172E also allows for this thing, so let's import that. The South Coast decision didn't say all of Section 172E applies. It answered EPA's argument and the argument by Baton Rouge that said, can we drop controls when EPA tightens the standard? Why don't I reserve the remainder of my time? Okay, thank you.
Morning. May it please the court. My name is Stephanie Talbert from the Department of Justice. With me at council table are Barbara Baird, counsel for the South Coast Air Management District, and Sarah Schneeberg and David Corson from EPA's Office of General Counsel. Petitioners challenge a guidance document in which EPA articulates its preliminary views with regard to how states can comply with Section 185 of the Clean Air Act.
Now, so if I'm a regional, if I'm an EPA regional administrator, and I get a submission from a state that does not have 185 fees in it, but an alternative that they claim is equally, no less stringent, can I reject it?
It depends on the basis for rejecting it.
Can I reject it because it doesn't have 185 fees in it?
I don't think the regional administrator would do that.
Okay, well, doesn't that resolve virtually every one of your jurisdictional questions? Doesn't that make this final agency action? Doesn't it make it completely right because it's a legal issue, and doesn't it clearly make it a legislative rule?
No, it doesn't. Because
why is that?
Because the agency wouldn't have rejected it out of hand prior to the guidance.
No.
So the guidance does not change.
Well, but the agency, before the guidance, I assume the agency, the regional administrator, might have had a choice. But after the guidance, you just agreed with me that that I would have no choice. I could not reject it. Correct? I couldn't reject it.
Well, the regional administrator couldn't reject it before the guidance came out. What I'm trying to say is that the guidance has not changed the legal landscape.
Why couldn't he have rejected it beforehand?
Because the agency would still have to apply the laws in place and would have looked to Section 172E as applicable by analogy and done an analysis.
Wait, before the guidance, he would have to reject, right?
No.
No?
No, Your Honor, because in submitting an alternative program to a regional administrator, the states could read Section 172E just as well as EPA mm-hmm. can, and this court's opinion in South Coast, and say, we think this alternative is not less stringent than a Section 185 fee program.
But
and
they'd have to make, post-guidance, he would have to make the stringency determination, right? He could only reject it if it was not less stringent, if it was not, in fact, equally stringent, right?
Well, we wouldn't concede that prior to the guidance he would not have had to make that determination.
Were there any submissions prior to the guidance that didn't have 185 fees in them?
Well, no. In Houston, the state specifically asked EPA to consider alternatives in addition to their fee program.
And why did it ask?
Based on Section 172.
Did it ask because it assumed it couldn't do it without agency clearance?
No, it asked as part of its state implementation mm-hmm. plan revision.
Yeah.
But it didn't have a sense, there's no sense that it was entitled to that, right? It was a request. It was asking for, not necessarily a waiver, but asking for something that wasn't apparent, it wasn't granted to it in the statute, right?
That's correct. It was asking for EPA's approval, just like it would ask for an approval of its Section 185 fee program. EPA reviews implementation plan revisions and either approves them or denies them, and there is some dialogue.
There's no difference in the request that was made before the guidance and after the guidance. The regional administrator didn't have any enhanced authority after the guidance to consider such a request?
No. It may have had additional information on what headquarters is thinking about this legal theory, but it didn't have additional authority that it didn't have before.
What do you think about the NRDC counsel's argument that you just heard, that there's nothing in the, he said there's nothing in the statute or the regulations or the case law that even suggests that non-185 alternatives are permissible.
We argue that that's contrary to what this court held in South Coast, mm-hmm. which is that 172, it's reasonable to apply Section 172E by analogy to the circumstances presented here where the one-hour standard has been revoked and the eight-hour standard is in place. It, not only does that provision, well, let me back up, that provision specifically says that EPA has to apply controls not less stringent than. It doesn't say EPA must apply exactly these controls. And so EPA has taken that phrase and applied it directly to Section 175 and said that it could approve programs that are not less stringent than Section 185.
So you read South Coast to say more than we're applying 172E as to the one-hour controls? Where it also went on to hold that 185 was a control?
It did go on to say Section 185 was a control, but this court didn't say that only Section 185 is required. The issue wasn't addressed in South Coast, whether EPA could accept not less stringent alternatives.
And so why isn't this a new legal determination by EPA that it's, again, applying 172E by analogy now to Section 185?
Well, it is a legal theory, but it's a preliminary theory that EPA has not come down finally on. EPA chose to advise states about this theory through a guidance document and not a rulemaking for a reason.
But, okay, so let's assume the state submits, Houston now submits its alternative. Would EPA reject it? Could EPA reject it on the grounds that it had an alternative to 185 fees?
If it ultimately decided that its legal theory was incorrect, it could.
I mean, it could reconsider that?
Yes, it can reconsider. And actually, in Baton Rouge, Baton Rouge submitted a termination determination because it has attained the one-hour standard. And in that in EPA's proposal to accept that determination, it put out its legal theory for notice and comment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a final.
What about
decision.
The attainment alternative? How is that consistent with South Coast?
Well, it's consistent because South Coast says Section 1, it's reasonable to apply Section 172E by analogy, and so the controls that were applicable under the one-hour standard are applicable now in the situation of EPA tightening the standard. So, and EPA...
But that's for the eight-hour, right?
Yes.
What about the one-hour?
Well, the purpose of Section 172E is to prevent backsliding.
Yeah, isn't that exactly what occurs here?
No,
under this rule?
It's not.
No?
Well, hypothetically, if EPA does approve a one-hour attainment or an eight-hour attainment, the purpose of the anti-backsliding provision would be met because in the one-hour situation, it's attained the very standard that Section
182... But isn't the agency assuming that the eight-hour provision would satisfy the one-hour? You're just assuming that, whereas it may not.
Well, we aren't assuming. We do acknowledge that it may not.
If it can't, then you've got a backsliding problem.
No, because the 8-hour standard has already been determined to be more protective of air quality. So if an area attains...
Isn't this exactly the argument that was rejected in South Coast?
I don't believe this argument was addressed in South Coast. In that decision, EPA had argued that we aren't going to be making non-attainment determinations for the one-hour standard because there is no shutoff, I guess, for the Section 185.
There was no reason for us in South Coast to address applying 172E as to the one-hour standard? I mean, isn't that the implication of your answer to Judge Tatel's question? In other words, the court thought that the one-hour standards had to be protected,
right.
And EPA was arguing, by analogy to the language Congress had adopted in 172E, right. That you could provide those protections by saying 172 anti-backsliding applies. So clearly, at least the court's concept of this was that the 8-hour standard wasn't solving all the problems.
I think what EPA is trying to do is extend what it had, what was addressed in the South Coast decision, and that is that EPA tried to drop the Section 185 program altogether, saying it didn't make sense to apply.
The hypothetical is Congress says do X, and it also says we don't want any backsliding, and the agency can always come up with and say, don't worry about X, you can come up with something else.
As long as it's equivalent, and I think that's important not to lose sight of that the EPA has said this preliminary view is only if states can show that a program is not less stringent.
Council's argument is that EPA had all this time to bring these standards into effect, these attainments, and it just wasn't happening. So Congress stepped in and took away some of the agency's discretion. All right, so the argument now is Mrs. McGill is living in an area that's protected by the 1-hour standard. But once this guidance came out, Houston said, forget it. We're not going to pursue that anymore. We're going to try to come up with some alternative. So the world has changed from Mrs. McGill's point of view.
But the guidance didn't cause or change the way that Section 185 was implemented. EPA has a process for implementing controls under the statutes through state.
What I don't understand is if I am the city of Houston trying to figure out how to comply, and I decide that the 185 fee program is just going to cause too many problems economically, et cetera, and so I say to EPA, I've got another plan that I think is at least as protective. And so I submit it to EPA, and EPA looks at it and finally says, I don't think so, Houston. So then I come back with another alternative, and EPA looks at it, I don't think so, Houston. And this goes on for 20 years. Meanwhile, Mrs. McGill has died from air pollution and ozone. I mean, the point is, how can Congress write a statute so that there are actual controls to be implemented if the agency is going to interpret the statute in a way that this is just an ongoing process and, you know, you can string this out for decades? And well, wasn't Congress reacting precisely to that problem when it amended the statute and took away some of EPA's discretion?
Well, I'd like to address two points with respect to that. First, EPA is not abandoning what Congress intended EPA to do. EPA has clearly said Section 185 applies, but if you can show us under 172E that it's not less stringent, then an alternative could possibly be approved.
But and then the whole question goes to whether or not that's consistent with what Congress has in mind here, and whether or not in issuing your guidance you haven't given a definitive legal interpretation that's subject to the APA.
We haven't given a
You may be right down the road, or you may prevail down the road, but the question is, how do you get there?
Well, as I said before, the agency hasn't given a definitive statement because it has only issued its explained its preliminary views that are subject to further consideration.
So how could Congress write a statute that would say to me as the city of Houston, I want you to implement those 185 fee programs now?
Congress could have said when the agency tightens a national ambient air quality standard, the same controls that were applicable under the prior standard are applicable now.
And I thought that's what South Coast was trying to address, saying EPA can tighten the standard, it can go from 1 hour to 8 hour standard, but those 1 hour controls have to remain in place.
That is what South Coast said, but right. South Coast didn't address the not less stringent than part of Section 172E.
Hasn't the legal environment changed? That's all we're getting at.
No.
Can I I'm sorry, Tom.
No, go ahead.
Okay. I want to ask you a question or two about the consequences of us disagreeing with you about whether this requires notice and comment rulemaking, okay? Let's assume we think it does, and we vacate. So number one is, what happens to the eight non-attainment areas? Would the EPA give them extensions until you finish the rulemaking, or would they have an obligation to submit new SIPs right away?
Well, currently, states have an obligation to submit SIP revisions, but they don't have any incentive to do so until EPA issues a finding of failure to submit.
What's the answer to my question then? The answer is not until you finalize the guidance, right? After notice and comment rulemaking, would they have to submit new SIPs?
They would still have the outstanding duty to submit new SIPs.
Yeah, but you wouldn't enforce it, right, until the guidance is issued. Is that the point? In other words, assume that we vacate, and the agency starts notice and comment rulemaking in response to our vacature. What would be the agency's position with respect to these eight areas' current obligations?
That they still have an obligation to submit an implementation plan revision.
Under the old rules? You mean with 185 fees in them?
Or an alternative program until EPA comes up with or finalizes.
What I'm getting at is, petitioner's concern about delay would continue, right?
Yes.
Okay. Number two is, I want to ask you the same question I asked counsel for NRDC about us ruling that the consequences of ruling that notice and comment rulemaking is required. Would that be the end of it, or what is the government's view about whether we should go ahead and decide? Address the merits.
We disagree with petitioners that the court should address the merits. If the court does vacate because it should have been a notice and comment ruling, then we would respectfully request that the court limit its holding to that because
the
agency.
Did you argue that in your brief?
No, we didn't address it because we don't think that the court should alter. We have argued that the.
You argued that no notice and comment is required. But your brief goes ahead and deals with the merits. You don't say anywhere in your brief that we should stop at notice and comment if we think it's required.
That's correct, but that is our position.
And suppose we thought that, I mean, take, for example, the attainment alternative. This is a hypothetical. Suppose we thought that it violated South Coast and the statute. What would be the reason for leaving that issue unresolved? Wouldn't the agency like to know that that's what we think about that issue before it goes through notice and comment? I mean, I can understand your position if we thought the statute was ambiguous, but just assume that we thought it was clear, both with respect to our own precedent and the statute. Why would we not decide that question?
Because the agency hasn't had an opportunity to fully develop its theory.
But my hypothetical is that we think it violates the statute and South Coast. And we think it's a Chevron 1 question. Why do we care what the agency? Wouldn't the agency want to know that? You're counsel to the agency. Wouldn't you want to know that, look, there's no reason to go through in the notice and comment with this attainment program because the court says it's illegal. Not a violation, not an abuse of discretion, but just a plain violation of the statute. Why wouldn't we say that?
Because the agency would like the opportunity to follow the procedures under the APA.
You mean to try to re-justify the attainment program alternative?
To more fully explain
the attainment program.
Yes.
Well, but my hypothetical was that we think it's a Chevron 1 issue, namely that the statute prohibits it. So there's no deference to the agency's interpretation. It's just a Chevron 1 question. The agency couldn't do anything in notice and comment that could change that.
Well, Your Honor, we disagree with the
I know you do. That's why I called it a hypothetical.
Yep.
Did you see my point?
I do.
And from the agency's perspective, wouldn't the agency want to know that?
I mean,
why would it want to go through notice and comment, redo the alternative, and just have it struck down the next time?
Well, I think I keep going back to this, but because the agency hasn't come to a final determination.
You don't like my hypothetical.
We will have. In our hypothetical, just
don't blame you.
We will have arrived at that.
You'd have to file a petition for rehearing and rehearing in bank saying we got it wrong.
See, I understand your point. I understand your point it seems to me you're clearly right. If my hypothetical were a different hypothetical, namely that we're in Chevron 1 land, that is Chevron 2, that is that the statute's ambiguous, then your point's very well taken. We would be prejudging, it seems to me, the notice and comment rulemaking if we were to say anything about it, because even if we thought right now that there was some question, well, even if we thought that the agency was right, you know, we would still be prejudging it because the purpose of notice and comment is for the agency to get the public's views and then to articulate its own view that we would then review. But I guess I don't see, I guess you haven't given me a reason yet for thinking why we would do that if we now thought, based on a fully briefed case, that we had a clear violation of the statute's language or of our own, even more so our own precedent. Forget the statute. Suppose we thought it violated South Coast. I mean, what would the agency, wouldn't the agency want to know that?
Well, regardless of whether the agency wants to know that, the court has jurisdiction only to review final agency actions.
Oh, that you're backing. I was saying, assume you lose all that we think this is final agency action and that it required notice and comment. I agree with you. If it's not final agency action, then we have a different game. But my hypothetical was that assume you lose on all your jurisdictional issues.
Well,
and the merits are properly before us.
We do still maintain that the court should allow the agency to follow its procedures. But if the court does reach the merits, EPA will certainly abide by any.
I would assume so.
Decision that the attainment alternative is not a permissible.
I'm not saying what I think about that. This was a total hypothetical about what we should do next, since neither of you briefed the issue at all.
We would
know,
be happy.
One side simply says we should go ahead and decide the merits, and the government doesn't say anything about it.
I'm sure both of us would be happy to submit supplemental briefing on that.
No, we haven't asked for that.
It's May.
My time has long since expired. Unless the court has further questions, we'll rest on our brief.
Thank you, counsel. Let's see, do we have? Oh, we have counsel for intervener.
Oh.
Mrs. Baird.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Barbara Baird, District Counsel for the South Coast Air Quality Management District. I'd like to address a couple points that have come up in discussion. First, NRDC in its reply brief, page 22, actually concedes that Section 172E does provide the flexibility that EPA is claiming, but they say not in this case. They don't explain why not in this case. Presumably, because they say that Section 172E doesn't apply to this case. That's in their brief, page 20. They simply say it's inapplicable. But this court, of course, has already upheld EPA's interpretation and stated that Section 172E regulates what EPA must do with revoked restrictions, and that's South Coast at page 899. Now, Congress knows expressly how to say that a regulation must stay in effect according to its terms unchanged. In fact, they did that in Section 193 of the Clean Air Act, where they had a similar backsliding provision, but used the language that the regulation stays in effect according to its terms. Here instead, they say that EPA must require provisions that are no less stringent than those that were in effect prior to the revocation of the standard. NRDC takes the position that Section 185 applies directly to this case. We disagree because the 1 hour standard has been revoked. So by its terms, 185 doesn't directly apply.
What's the South Coast?
Pardon me?
What do you do with South Coast?
I believe the court in that case said that the 185 applies pursuant to the principles of Section 172. And EPA nor...
All EPA argued, as I recall, is that it was applying 172E by analogy to the one-hour standards.
Yes.
And the court said fine.
Because EPA made...
Well, even EPA counsel acknowledges EPA is going a step further, something that wasn't decided in South Coast, and trying to apply 172E to 185.
Well, I think the court already held that 172E applies to 185. That's how...
The issue wasn't in the case?
Well, the issue of the second half of Section 172E was not in the case. The issue was the first half of 172, which says keep control requirements in effect. That was in the case. But I submit that plaintiffs have not offered any theory or any authority for the ability of a statute to apply halfway. In other words, if 185 doesn't directly apply, and EPA conceded that 185 doesn't directly apply, it applies because it's a control listed in 172, how can we then argue that the whole section, 172, doesn't apply to this case? It doesn't make sense, and I haven't seen any authority for the proposition that half a statute that's only one sentence long applies to the facts of this case. Your Honor, I'd like to address Judge Rogers' question about an agency potentially submitting a long series of unsuccessful attempts to demonstrate that the rule is not less stringent. That can't happen. EPA is required to impose sanctions within 18 months of a finding of failure to submit. And so... Yes.
They submitted, and the agency is looking it over.
Yes.
So there's been no violation by the covered jurisdiction.
Right. But if EPA then disapproves that because sanction, because it didn't meet the requirements, then my understanding of the sanction is that the sanction then goes into effect unless EPA has approved a substitute program, not unless it's submitted, unless it's approved. You only get one bite of the apple under the sanctions provision.
So we thought, all right, and that's not what's happened in this long-standing process.
Well, I would respectfully disagree with that. The obligation to submit the program was triggered by EPA's finding a failure to submit.
Right. No, I'm not suggesting, let me be very clear about this, any chicanery by anybody, anyone say, I hypothesize I was the city working for the city of Houston, and I submit this updated plan, and EPA says, well, you know, we might be able to agree with this alternative if you could adjust these four controls. And Houston says, let me look at that. Let me see if I can adjust those. And say, comes back and says, well, we can't adjust those, but we can adjust these. What do you think of that? I mean, this just gets
No, I disagree with that. My understanding of the sanction provision is that once you get the one bite at the apple, EPA has to have approved your next submittal.
So they get up or down, and that you're in or out?
You get up or down, you get a second chance, but with that second chance, EPA has to have approved that submittal to avoid sanctions. You can't keep going over and over again. I see my time has expired, so unless the court has any questions, I'd be
Is there any other point you wanted to make?
Yes, the issue in this case is narrow. NRDC says in its reply that it's not challenging whether any given program is equivalent or not equivalent, but only whether EPA has any authority at all to allow any alternative. We state submit that the answer is yes.
All right. Counsel for petitioner.
I just wanted to point, Your Honors, to a few relevant portions of the briefs and records. First, on this question of whether the world has changed for regional administrators out there.
Yes, what's the answer to that?
I think if you look at what happened in San Joaquin, you can see that the world has changed. San Joaquin submitted a plan that did not comply with Section 185. Commenters, EPA proposed to disapprove.
What?
EPA, the Region 9, proposed to disapprove the plan because it didn't comply with Section 185.
This was post-guidance?
No, pre-guidance.
Pre-guidance.
Pre-guidance. Commenters said, because they knew that this question was bubbling at EPA through this task force that EPA created, commenters said, why don't you treat this or why don't you consider this as an equivalent, an alternative program? And on December 11th, 2009, so this is a month before the guidance, the Region 9 Regional Administrator signed the final disapproval, and in the preamble said, EPA has not yet stated whether it would approve such programs. Mm-hmm. Now, EPA has, Regional Administrator would not be free to sort of draw this line and say, we're not even going to consider whether this is an equivalent alternative.
That action in San Joaquin, that was by the regional office. Well, I assume counsel's answer to that would be, well, they were wrong. Pre-guidance, they could.
So EPA headquarters is going to say that its regional administrator acted unlawfully.
Well, but isn't that what counsel said to me? She said that prior, I'm not saying that she said that San Joaquin was wrong, the regional administrator. But didn't she say to me that pre-guidance, the agency had the regional directors? Whatever.
Administrators.
Regional administrator had the authority to accept a plan or consider a plan, didn't have 185E.
Right, and that's not correct. They did not have that authority. There is no authority. There's nothing in the law that says anything like that. They had to invent that law in this guidance.
So your answer is that there's no statutory or precedential authority for it, and that in fact the regional administrators, as in Joaquin, were rejecting such plans.
Exactly, and I find it interesting too that the Air District is arguing that they assume that this was always the case when the South Coast Air District went through this same transformation. They had adopted a program that complied with Section 185, and then following the guidance, they jettisoned that draft proposal and adopted a new proposal that looked into these alternatives.
Keep going. I'm sorry. Ignore us. Just forget us.
The one other thing I would ask the court to struggle with a little bit in sort of figuring out, you know, if it makes a difference just to let this thing linger, let EPA take another crack at this, which, you know, I don't think is necessary. It's ripe. You know, it's a purely legal question. It's not going to get any better. We can, you know, answer this question once and for all. But under Section 185D of the Clean Air Act, EPA is supposed to be collecting these penalties right now if the state is not doing it. And the fear is that as long as EPA sort of drags this thing out and is uncertain about its legal position or how it's, you know, going to proceed, those penalties aren't going to be collected. And there is an opportunity here for the court to say, this is what the law requires. Those fees need to be imposed unless Congress steps in, and you need to comply with Section 185D.
So in your interpretation, if I am the city of Houston and I submit an alternative and EPA rejects it, when do the penalties kick in? Is it retroactive?
Yes, and the statute expressly says past due retroactive fees.
So if I am not collecting these fees now, I'm taking that risk.
I guess that's right. Yes, that's fair.
Anything further?
Nope, I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We would like to ask counsel for EPA if you could come forward. Judge Taylor.
What's your response to counsel's description of the San Joaquin situation?
Our response is that it is inaccurate. Okay. What happened in that case was that San Joaquin did submit alternative programs, but those programs weren't consistent with Section 185, and EPA said that San Joaquin did not ask or make a showing of equivalency under 172E. So it's not true to
say. Is this in the record?
It is cited by the Federal Register site is 75 Federal Register 1716.
So your position is that the regional administrator rejected it not because it didn't have 185 fees, but because it wasn't equivalent?
I think it was a mix of both. It pointed out the fact that what San Joaquin was suggesting was not consistent with Section 185, it didn't make an equivalency demonstration.
But now the first point is now different, correct, as a result of the guidance. In other words, EPA has now clarified that that first point, that is, that it didn't have 185 fees, is not a basis for rejecting the plan, correct?
No.
No?
Because if an area decides to proceed with a Section 185 fee program.
Stick with what you just told me. You said the regional administrator rejected it for two reasons. One is that it didn't have 185 fees, and number two is whatever it had wasn't equivalent, correct?
It didn't make a showing of equivalency.
Right.
There was nothing for EPA to evaluate.
Two bases for rejecting it, right?
Right.
Okay, now after the guidance, the regional administrator can no longer rely on the first one, right?
No, it can rely on the first one because the substance of the Section 185 fee program that was submitted was not equivalent or was not.
You're missing my point.
I'm sorry.
I agree that afterwards they can reject it because it wasn't equivalent. But could the administrator rejected it for the first reason given in the San Joaquin case, namely that it didn't have 185 fees at all?
That wasn't the situation in San Joaquin.
I was simply relying on what you told me, which is that there were two reasons. Isn't that what you said?
Yes.
Okay.
But I think Your Honor is misunderstanding the first reason.
Well, then explain it to me.
Section 185, what San Joaquin was, it tried to exempt certain major sources from a straight Section 185 fee program.
Yeah.
And EPA said, you can't do it. And these other things that you've submitted as alternative programs, you haven't shown us anything that we can evaluate.
Gotcha.
For equivalency.
That's what I thought you meant. Now, after the guidance, the regional administrator can't make the first point, correct?
Yes, it can. If San Joaquin submits a straight 185 fee program with those exemptions.
No, it submits a plan with no 185 fees, none. He can't say now that that is unlawful, correct?
He couldn't say that before the guidance.
You just told me that's what he said.
Okay. What is that Federal Register site? You said 75 Federal Register.
1716.
Yes. Thank you.
Give me a chance. Counsel for NRDC, would you just quickly respond to this, please? Yeah. I mean, we can go read this eventually, but would you just help us right now?
Right.
Yeah.
But so here is the quote from that final notice.
Piece of paper. Go ahead.
EPA has not yet stated whether it would approve such programs.
That's what we'll find at 7:05.
Therefore what? Therefore he rejected it?
Therefore they weren't going to consider this exit ramp of an alternative.
So did he go ahead and say, in any event, it wasn't equivalent?
They did say, Council for EPA is right, that they did say that San Joaquin didn't ask for that special treatment.
I see.
But they concluded that it wasn't even a legal option because no one has decided whether they can approve those things.
And in the comments that were submitted on this, were the commenters saying this is not lawful?
We submitted comments That's saying right. it was not lawful. Industry submitted comments saying that EPA was considered, you know, that this idea was bubbling around and EPA should treat it as an alternative program.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Council. We will take this matter under advisement.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30.